Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Elixir Mix. On our panel today, we have Eric Bolakowski. I'm always worried I'm going to say your name wrong, Eric.
It's getting better and better. Keep at it, Chuck.
I'm still saying it wrong. All right. I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. And we have Adi Iyengar here. He's going to talk to us about Phoenix testing, which is always exciting. Adi, do you want to just introduce yourself real quick? I see you're writing a book with Pact Publishing, which is also exciting. You have a blog, which is kind of where we found you. But yeah, who are you? Like, where are you from? What do you do?
Sure.
Elixir? Yeah.
Sure, yeah. So I'm Adi. I work as a backend engineer community. I have been working with Elixir since 2015, and since then I have authored a few open source packages and contributed to a few of them, including Elixir itself. Super passionate about functional programming, test-driven development, and just promoting Elixir, right? And that's one of the big reasons why the next step for me was to write a book. You know, I find ways to contribute in the community, you know, like I organize Boston meetups and contribute to open source, but like writing a book kind of creates that multiplicative effect where people can learn and themselves start contributing. So that was the motivation behind writing a book.
Did you work your tail off to get that senior developer gig just to realize that senior dev doesn't actually mean dream job? I've been there too. My first senior developer job was at a place where all of our triumphs were the bosses and all the failures were ours. The second one was a great place to continue to learn and grow, only for it to go under due to poor management. And now I get job offers from great places to work all the time. Not only that, but the last job interview I actually sat in was a discussion about how much my podcast had helped the people interviewing me. If you're looking for a way to get into your dream job, then join our Dev Heroes Accelerator. Not only will we help you get the kind of exposure that makes you attractive to your dream employer, but you'll be able to ask them for top dollar as well. Check it out at devheroesaccelerator.com. I gotcha. How far into the book are you?
Yes, I'm done with the first two chapters, and we expect to publish that around October, November period.
Gotcha. Having written a book, it's a lot of work, so.
Definitely it is.
Yeah. But anyway, so you posted this blog post on my thoughts on testing Phoenix controller plug setup. And so, yeah, I'm wondering if you can just back up a little bit and tell us kind of the background behind this particular blog post. Like, why'd you write it? It seems pretty fundamental, right? You know, plug
right.
And controllers. So, yeah.
Right. So this is like, it came off from like a symptom that I noticed that a lot of times when a plug is being used in several controllers and the plug itself has, several use cases, all the use cases are not tested in the controller test. And you know, by the way, I'm saying controller test, but in Phoenix, controller test really means it tests endpoint, router, controller, views, ergo templates. But the controller tests don't really test all the use cases for plugs. And you know, it you can say it's not needed, right? Because a plug is tested, but we're not really testing. We're not being explicit about what we're testing, right? And so my motivation was, how can we incentivize people to, you know, when you write a controller and you expect a plug to be called, to test their expectations correctly, right? And a great way to incentivize people is to reduce the number of lines of code, right? And also, like, you know, another side of this is like something I call usage testing, but it's really unit testing, but a more specific case of that, where if you have two components of software, A and B, and A uses B, then testing how A uses B should be somewhat enough, given that B is tested sufficiently, right? And so instead of testing all the integration cases of A, of B through A, just see, is A using B correctly? Mm-hmm. And just to like give an example, and like from Ruby on Rails community, there's something called shoulda matches, which test, you know, if you have a model post, and post requires, you know, title, right? And shoulda matches allow you to say, okay, expect post to require titles, but it doesn't create a post in the database and inserts it and sees without a title if there's an error. It actually tests the presence of the line validate require title, right? Instead of testing the effect, it tests that you're calling it correctly. And it's along the same lines. So it incentivizes people to write that because it's just one liner. And it also kind of, you're accepting the fact that you can never really test all the use cases, because at some point the plug's going to get complicated enough that you'll miss something.
Right. So I also, I'm going to admit that I'm a little out of practice with Elixir.
Sure.
So I've kind of run through some examples. I've put plugs into my controllers. I get that they kind of modify my, you know, my pipeline, but they're still magic to me.
Right.
It's kind of how I'm going to put it. So can you just explain a little bit of how they work? And then we can talk about, yeah, a little bit more on, okay, what's your approach to testing them that is different maybe from how other people are doing it?
Right. So in effect, what plugs do is what in Rails controller, what are they called? Callbacks? Before actions, right?
Before action.
Right. Yeah. What they do. And how kind of Phoenix works is that there is a centralized construct called plug.con. And that structure is what gets, you know, updated throughout the pipeline. And a plug is a way to update that con, right?
Right.
And if, say, you are sending an authorization token, for example, a plug, one of the plug's responsibility could be to decode that token and see if the user is correctly, you know, assigned, and then assign that user, the decoded version of that user, to that con for further usage.
Right.
Right. So that's where you would use a plug.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm, you know, I'm much more familiar with Rails, but with Rails, what you wind up doing is, I mean, anything that's within the context you can basically touch, right? But Elixir's functional programming. And so effectively you're saying you pass in the con. And so you're somewhat, I guess, more limited or more focused on what you actually can change, right? So it's anything on that con object, you know, so your, I guess, your request, your response, things like that are all contained in that con.
Totally.
And so, okay. Yeah. Because, yeah, I haven't written my own plug. And so I'm just like, oh, it does this nice thing for me. And then I, you know, magic ensues. And then it, you know, it does the right thing. And so that's where I was. Okay, that makes sense.
Really, a shameless plug, by the way, about the book itself. The book I'm writing is actually walks you through writing Phoenix, building Phoenix. And it actually covers how to write a plug construct and how to build a controller from scratch, and then kind of wrap it into the Phoenix DSL that makes it look, you know, clean. So if you want to learn, Chuck, how plugs work better, maybe you should get the book.
Gotcha. I will. I'll happily check it out. We'll have you back on when it comes out. But yeah, okay. Nice. So, go ahead. Sorry, Eric.
Yeah.
I'm talking too much.
Yeah. that sounds great. I mean, for me, it's interesting. I've been around, you know, hanging around JavaScript and Node and React and this kind of JavaScript full stack world for quite a long time now. So, and I know close to nothing about Ruby and Rails, and I'm new to Elixir. And I admit that I did 2 hours of background reading about Phoenix today because I'm still kind of grasping Elixir and then going on to Phoenix. And I was like reading a lot of posts about this. And it was interesting when I was trying to figure out what was actually plugs. And it kind of reminded me about this thing that we have in, I don't know how much you know about Node, but there's something called Express, which is the typical backend server. Mm-hmm. And there's like a chain of middlewares. So you basically can chain the request that is incoming through a bunch of middlewares. And then there's this hot new backend framework that's called Nest.js, which is a bit to Elixir. It's, I think, Nest to Node is what Phoenix is to Elixir, I mean, from what I've gathered so far. Mm. And Nest is very elegant notion of, like, you can actually chain stuff through a bunch of pipes. You can basically pipe the request through a bunch of interceptors before it makes it to the actual control method. And for me, this is kind of like pretty well what I've seen about plugs so far. And also the context object that you're building up. And to me, it's so fascinating that we actually have this very neat thing in Phoenix and Elixir that you just have this pipe. You're piping something through a bunch of different steps, and it's the happy path. And if something fails, then you follow the principle of Erlang that it should fail. And you let the more intelligent, you know, Erlang engine catch the failure and then see what happens then. But it's mostly about the happy path. And then it's basically a bunch of check marks that things have to go through before we can proceed. That's how I have understood it so far. Is that correct, actually? Any lights to shed on that image that I'm building?
I think that's a very good image, actually. The middleware is a great way to look at plugs. And you brought up a very good point about the whole happy path. And Phoenix and Elixir, kind of, they go out of their way to facilitate you to code in that way, right? Phoenix introduced in 1.3 something called fallback controller. Its purpose is to let you focus on happy path. So all the errors are handled at that central place, fallback control, which itself is a plug. And again, the focus on happy path is, like you said, it really catalyzes usage of plugs really well.
Nice. Yeah, super interesting. So you basically have happy path and then one place where all of the other things can be closed. Right. Yeah. In React, there's this notion of, it's very well worded. It's called an error boundary. If something can bubble up and then it's caught in this bound, which is basically like a safety net.
Awesome, yeah.
So let's go back here and let's talk about, now that we're kind of got our foundation here for plugs. So when you test plugs, right, you essentially just test that the con has whatever changes the plug would have made to it, right? Is that essentially what you're testing in the normal way of doing it, right?
Right. If you're testing the plug itself, right, in isolation, mm-hmm. you test what changes it makes to the con. Yep.
Right.
Just to clarify, con is context, right?
Connection, really.
Connection. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So the kind of request response object or?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Nice. Okay. Yeah.
You have the con instance. Sorry, I couldn't help it. Could not. Help. Okay. Anyway. So, all right. So
Star Trek fan hair as well. Go on.
So what do you advocate doing differently then?
Right. I'm not really advocating changing the way you test the plug, but changing the way you test the controller itself. So just taking the example from the post, right? So there's the page controller, right? And there's a plug which tests whether, you know, the user going to a specific action has a claim that's required for that action. For example, page index would need a claim called page read, right? Uh-huh. So how you would traditionally test it is a controller test, create a con with page read, go to index and see whether you get a 200. And if it doesn't have page read, say if you get like a, you know, 404, 409, mm-hmm. 401, whatever you've configured, right? But if you add that action in every controller, you have to have those use cases. Like, you know, there's a potential for, you know, 409 if the, or 422 mm-hmm. if the token isn't structured correctly and whatnot, right? So you cannot test all the use cases for all the actions in every controller. By experience, mm-hmm. I know it doesn't happen, right? It happens the first time, but developers hate writing tests. So instead, what you should test is, does your controller call plug require claims with these options instead of testing mm-hmm. each action? So it's testing the usage instead of testing the effect.
Okay. So then do you effectively stub out the, do you stub out the claims or?
It's not really stubbed out because there is no clean way of doing that in Elixir. We still test the happy path in controller, but all the other things we don't worry about because we assume that it's tested sufficiently. And all we do is, towards the end, you can see like there is something called a uses plug. And use this plug just test whether a controller uses this plug with these options. Okay. So that was the idea. Sorry, go ahead.
I saw that in there. I was wondering if that was an API you built, or was that an API that?
Yeah, the pretty much the whole thing after the controller and controller test, I built that because so Phoenix is great, but I think it lacks a lot of introspective features. You know, when you add a plug mm-hmm. to the controller, it's mm-hmm. really not possible for you to inspect it after the controller is defined. That's why I needed that before compile hook to create a method, define a method using macros.
Okay.
To later use for an introspection for testing.
I gotcha.
How have other developers in your experience already kind of compensated with this lack of introspection? I mean, you kind of have to introduce this pre-compile step, this directives that are being used in the tests, but also in the code. How have other people's, I mean, when they want to test similar things, do they also have other solutions for this?
Yeah, from my experience, I think people, it's a little looked down upon in the Elixir community to write tests like this. And you know, believe me, I ideally would love to write integration tests too, which is why a lot of, you know, Elixir core team people don't have support for running tests like this. They want you to write all integration tests, right? But in effect, if you're working in a company, you see that, you know, even the best places don't have, you know, all the use cases tested for all the controllers. And if you accept that, you can like kind of compromise a little bit and say, okay, this plug is sufficiently tested. Now, unfortunately, I have to incentivize people to write this test. Therefore, let's make this one-liner that people can just put, write their expectations in. It's funny, like I opened a proposal in the Elixir groups for Elixir language itself. And Jose kind of turned that down after like a few comments. And the comment was like, you know, the use keyword that calls the using macro of a module. The proposal was to store all the uses for a module in the module, right? So you can see whether a module is using something. And motivation behind that was, hey, can I just test that this module is using this module instead of having to test the effect of using that module? Right. But again, yeah, like I said, it's like looked down upon. And I think I also didn't do a good job selling that. So, because I do believe that's a place we'll, at least some people will tend to go, because the community is still new. And, you know, I'm sure people will either realize we need that, or maybe I'm terribly wrong.
Well,
makes sense.
History will tell. Yeah, that's right. I'm sure you had a great experience going just down this path, and we had other guests on the podcast that were, you know, testing the boundaries of Elixir in different ways just for having the experience of it. So, in many ways, it's still useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because there are things that were exceptionally frowned upon in the various communities that I've been involved in over the years, that as time went on and opinions changed, people kind of got to be okay with. And so it's interesting, you know, we may come back around to this in a few years and somebody may go, why are we doing this? And somebody else will go, oh yeah. Yeah. Why are we doing this? And then, you know, so who knows, right?
Hopefully.
All right. So you put the uses plug in. I'm just kind of walking through this article, right? Mm-hmm. Uses plug ? In, right?
Right.
And so now you're testing, hey, is it using this plug, right? Mm-hmm. And so now you've got to crack open the controller, right? And see what plugs it's using, right?
Right.
And so how did you do that? How did you actually get that information out?
Right. Yeah. So I had to look at how the controller pipeline works in Phoenix. And it's a lot of kind of a scattered metaprogramming, because I think a lot of that code was written a while ago. So I figured that there's this module attribute called plugs, where anytime you make a plug call, it's all the plug calls are accumulated in that, along with the AST version, the quoted expression version of the options.
Oh, really? But
because you don't want to evaluate the options right then. You want to save it for when the plug is being called. But you want to save the call, record the call itself. And it's it's very interesting, because the module attribute is only used like once at like later on to define functions that are further called when you call the controller. And I figured maybe I can just write a before compile hook. All that does is it defines a function plugs, which returns that module attribute. So the function is defined and the module attribute is deleted after the module is compiled, but I still have access to that function. And I used the web.ex file, where all the controller macros exist, to add that before compile hook. It's actually in the blog post. It's a relatively bigger blog post. It's in taking it a step further section. If you can see that on the left side in the table of contents, that's where I define a before compile hook that defines a plug _ plugs function.
Yeah. So you define the function and then you're able to access that plugs. And so then you just check it and make sure that the plug is in there, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. The tricky part was also, you can write like guard clauses with the plugs, just like in Rails. You can do before action if the action is index. Similarly, you can do plug require capabilities if the action is index. And those things are coded expressions. So towards the end, I kind of just like go down a little bit of a philosophical rabbit hole about, you know, how should it test that? So because coded expressions are evaluated in a context, right? And if I define a coded expression in the test, the context mm-hmm. will be different from the defining it in the controller. So I just test the literal string version of the quoted expression, which is not logical equivalence, it's literal equivalence. But you know, you have to compromise at some point, right?
I know, I'm sitting there trying to figure out how I feel about
that. Right.
But yeah, I mean, we all go to that place, right, where it's, I'm going to do, it's gross, but I'm going to make it work. And right. then, right, and then I'll go see if I can ungross it. But yeah, right. yeah. So yeah, did you end up with something that you're actually comfortable releasing for people to use? Or was this just more of a mental exercise?
This is actually in our production code. And I mean, the quoted expressions part, testing the literal equivalence, I think that's fine because there's not really many combinations that you can write three words in, right? And it will still not give you a compilation error. So yeah, I think this is a perfectly fine way to test things, which, and it really satisfied a use case of making sure that we, you know, test whether A uses B correctly. In fact, the same philosophy and that's going to be my next blog post, we're using for router test, which is actually not even a thing. There are no router tests in Phoenix, but using the same philosophy of, hey, do these routes use these pipelines defined in the router? We can kind of, you know, at least make sure that if we change the pipeline, some tests will break, right?
Right.
So the same philosophy we're going to apply to routers, and I'm going to have a few kind of blog posts in this usage testing umbrella coming up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
I'm getting a bit philosophical here. I mean, I think that, I'll put this, isn't kind of the point of tests to increase our level of confidence about code? That's like one of the takeaways that I've seen from a couple of conferences I've been to. And when there are routes that are, you know, so declarative and are so straightforward and rely on something that seems to be, you know, as robust as Phoenix is, what is kind of like the it seems like you're basically just having a second layer of declarations about what your routes should be. It's almost as if you're just copy pasting the actual code into this kind of header file, so to speak, just to confirm what you already have implemented, which is already kind of self-evident. Is it actually really needed? I would perhaps, you know, just to play devil's advocate here, what is actually the point of having something granular as router tests?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And so this is the basics. I mean, the simple argument for this is a typo, right? If you have two pipelines, authorized client one, authorized client two, that, you know, many companies do that, V1, V2, right? If somehow there's a typo, you change V1 to V2, you want a test to break, right? So the sanity test approach, right? So no typos get into it. And you can say that, you know, the PR review process should catch that, but you probably want a machine to catch that. So that was the initial approach. And the second reason is same as incentivizing testing. If the same pipelines are used across, and pipeline consists of plugs, right? And if the same pipeline is used for like 10 routes, are you going to test all the use cases of that pipeline for every route? Probably not, right? So just testing whether the route calls the pipeline should be sufficient. It's again, like I said earlier, in an ideal world, I love integration tests because I never compromise running tests. But unfortunately, vast majority of people are not like that. So
sorry
Chuck. We'll have a heads up. Yeah, I think on one hand you're doing automation, which is really good. That's one of the things that testing really can really help out with, you know, to save the manual testing basically, and the second, of course, for security purposes. And that's actually two very good points.
Yeah, I mean, for the typo thing, I don't see that very often. And so the amount of value that I would get out of routing tests for that, I agree with Eric's original point. I just don't know that I see it there. As far as knowing that a particular route is tested because the pipeline behind it is getting tested, I do like that argument. I really, that makes some sense to me, right? Because I can actually see my way to, okay, I want to know if somebody hits this, that it's hitting something that I can understand and, you know, rely on, right? Because the rest of it has this test around it, right?
Right.
And so I like that. But yeah, as far as typos in routes, that stuff's just going to happen. And if it's a typo in the code that processes the route, then yeah, I mean, it's just not, it's not something that changes often enough to where a critical route is going to get messed up, in my opinion. But yeah,
it actually did happen to me.
Here we go.
I did not want to say that because it did happen in one of my previous companies. That's why I brought that up. Another like thing I think about is like mutation testing, you know, explicitly introducing changes to your code and making sure a test breaks. Like this will facilitate that, right? Like, yeah, to make sure that each route, each line of code has an equivalent test that breaks if you change that line of code. Yeah, but you're right. The main argument was the same as that I mentioned earlier, which is ensuring that a route goes through a pipeline.
Yeah. So yeah, when that makes sense.
Well, let's wander off into the kind of realm of TDD. How do you generally approach actual new development projects? Do you like to actually write the tests first and then the code, or vice versa? Or I guess at some point you have some kind of mix.
Oh yeah, let's do all the holy wars.
You're getting into it.
I'm a big TDD guy. It actually was ingrained in me from my first job. My mentor at my first company, he was also the CTO of the company, and he kind of grilled it in me, even though he doesn't follow it all the time. he put me to that standard. Whoa, and yeah, but I'm at a place now where it's if I do it, it just sets the tone for my entire project. And without doing that, my productivity gets like, you know, 50% hit usually, especially if it's a project which, you know, if I have done something similar like that before, writing tests really keep me on track and, you know, not get distracted by, oh, maybe I can do this differently or that differently. It's it makes sure that I, you know, deliver what's expected. In fact, it's funny, I was at a point in my previous company where I was taking requirements from the product owner and I was writing tests as I was taking requirements. It wasn't like my notes. I was literally writing test cases and all I had to do was go back and just get those tests passed. And
the feature was delivered.
Beautiful.
I love that. All right, Eric, are you a TDD guy?
No, I'm not.
Ooh, here we go. Why not?
I've never wandered into that world, actually. I do write some tests, but I'm actually much more of a manual testing guy. Okay. You took me.
I'm always curious, right? I like this
concept of confidence in your code. And you know, at a certain point I just have so much confidence in my code. That sounds kind of arrogant, but I hope you can roll with me here. It's kind of, when a certain thing has been so well battle tested over a while, then you kind of, it doesn't fail. But now I will actually admit that has come back to bite me pretty hard in the ass now, because there's some issue that is now popping up, and I think it's because of a module that is required by one of the packages that I'm using on a Node.js backend, and it's actually causing a bit of a hiccup in some environments that I'm responsible for. So I have scheduled 3 hours of time later this week just to investigate what is going on there, and I have no clue. If I had a test, I think I could have saved me. So I actually had this on my to-do list for a very long time now. It's a course that I bought 2 years ago by Gay in the JavaScript community that's called Kenzie Dodds. It's very famous. He has this great testing JavaScript course, and I still have yet to complete it. And
he's cutting out. Yeah, well, I will say that.
I'm getting close.
Yeah, go ahead.
See, getting closer to the point of actually doing the JavaScript course. Keep on talking. I will switch to a mobile net.
No, it's all good. Oh, yeah. So yeah, I know Kent because he lives out here in Utah, and I've known him for quite a long time. But and it's great that you're looking at picking up testing. I will tell you that honestly, the big thing for me, and I will admit I don't test everything. but I do get unit tests around pretty much anything at the sort of class or module level that I can. And then I tend to do the end-to-end tests for at least the stuff that's like mission critical. And the reason is because what I find is that if I don't do that, people are like, well, it's a really simple app and you don't really need that. Yeah, you say that, and then week three, it goes beyond really simple app, okay? It's just reality. The other thing is that, and I could go on and on and on. Of course, my thinking is tainted by talking to Bob Martin every month, once or twice a month. So take that with a grain of salt. But I've seen this, especially lately with my full-time job. So there are two teams working on the same project. And we tend to work on things that don't cross the streams all the time, right? We deliberately try to make sure that we're not doing that. But the reality is that sometimes stuff crosses the streams, or we'll work on something that they worked on last time, right? And if I get in and I start working on something and I assume that I know how the code works and I write and you know, I change something or add something and then the code breaks the test, the build fails, right? It makes a big difference for me to be able to go back and at least go to them, or sometimes go to myself and say, duh, you knew this, right? Because sometimes it's my own test, right, that breaks. You know, who wrote this? This code is awful. Get blame. Never mind. Right? But I had the test there, right, to tell me, hey, look, you assumed that it was going to do this thing. It was going to have this behavior. It was going to have this outcome. And I just can't fly without it anymore, right? I don't have any of those instruments. And to your case, Eric, sometimes it's not my code that breaks, right? Sometimes I'll upgrade a library or I'll pull in something from somewhere else. And the next thing I know, something's breaking. And so I can roll back until the test pass, right? And go, oh, you know, I'm going to roll in this change. Oh, it was this library. Something changed right here. And then I go look and see what changed in the API or that behavior. And so, yeah, I don't roll without tests anymore. And if I'm paying people to write code for me, I don't pay them to write it without tests anymore, because it's not worth it. I can't count on the code, and I can't code against it and not know that I'm not screwing something up. And the last thing I need is for the, hey, pay me right here page to go down. So,
right.
That's the worst case scenario. I think especially like for me, it's such an easy sell. I think I will start doing this very soon to write, you know, complete end-to-end tests using Cypress to test the happy path. That's like the,
I love Cypress.
It's great.
Yeah. I'll warn you though.
Testing JS conference. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll warn you because getting started is slow, right? It is. It's just slow. And so some people, they get frustrated with that, or their boss will get frustrated with it, because you will see a slowdown when you get started because your muscles just aren't built up to it yet. But once you get used to it, and once you really, it's not just getting in the practice of doing it, but it's also the fact that you have to set up some infrastructure for it and stuff like that. But eventually you'll start seeing the payoffs because you'll stop making some of the mistakes that you're paying for right now. But you don't get those payoffs right away, and you're spending extra time figuring stuff out. And so you have to give it like 3 to 6 months just to get enough lift off to have it start paying off. But then once you're up in the air, you'll get payoff after payoff after payoff.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So it is so true. Yeah.
No, go for it.
I was just going to give another like anecdote. Like my wife just started coding. She started her new software developer job last month, and I kind of coached her, and like obviously the TDD, you know, instilled in her the TDD methodology. And it's really great. Like the best thing right now she can do is write specs of R spec in Ruby. And it's funny, I was like showing her the other day, I just built like a blockchain in Ruby, and I was just to show her something new. And then I was testing that, and she was like, wait, but you're not testing that thing. I'm like, wow, nice. So she's actually she's now finding things that I'm not testing. So yeah, it pays off really, really fast once you internalize the fact that you ever test everything.
Yep.
Yeah, you start to think about the different code paths and different things that will happen. I mean, I actually spend a lot of time just like, you know, sketching out different user journeys and things on my on my notepad, and that's the way I approach things. But I think it's when you start writing tests, then you perhaps will also fit more stuff into your little brain. So, and
yep.
Yeah, I'm sold. Now we'll have to nice. Commit to this.
So, two things real quick. One is I may or may not, there may or may not be a video of me building blockchain in Ruby on the internet somewhere. So,
oh, wow.
The second thing is, yeah. I did it at a users group. I was going to speak at a conference and my dad passed away like right before the conference. And so I called those guys up and I said, I'm not speaking at the conference because I can't even function right now. And they were totally good with it. But I gave the talk at a users group and they recorded it. So, and that was fun. Anyway, that's a total side note. The other thing though is I'm kind of curious now that we're kind of into this and we're talking about testing. I want to bring this back to testing, say controllers and Phoenix. What's your overall approach to testing Phoenix, right? So when you start up a new Phoenix project, what are you using? And then as you get into it, you know, how do you approach building and testing your application?
Yeah, that's such a great question. In fact, it's like it keeps evolving how I do it. The latest side project that I, and generally my side projects are better tested than my work projects, because you know I don't have enough time to add all the tests at my work projects. But the latest one that I added, I start with the Cypress test, integration test, end-to-end test. Really, it's I think that like those basic tests of like really basic functionalities. What happens when you click on this? You expect this, right? Like those things are very important, and for those to work better, like having like more idempotent seeds, like you know, seeds that you run no matter how many times yield the same data that you can use for testing properly. That has been my approach to setting up tests, like, you know, kind of going the Cypress way. The Phoenix, the Elixir tests really come naturally to me. Like I do TDD. So everything I write the Elixir tests first. This Cypress test is something that I need more effort to, you know, mm-hmm. I have to like explicitly write those tests before. Also, Phoenix doesn't really have a good way of testing HTML that's rendered, especially if you're using the EEX templates, whether using Live View or regular mm-hmm. view. It's like there's like Floki, which parses HTML. And I'm not a fan of that. So again, a reason to use Cypress to make sure buttons are working correctly, your links are working correctly. So yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, we're kind of getting toward the end of our time. Is there anything else that you think people ought to know or be aware of related to this blog post?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, yeah, keep your eye out for other usage testing blog posts coming up in the next couple months, if this is interesting for you guys. But hopefully I'll come here soon to talk about my book next time.
All right. Sounds good. Hey, folks. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been working a lot on figuring out how to help people become the most valuable developers on their teams, or becoming the top 5% of developers in the field. If you're looking to level up, figure out how to contribute more, get the career you want, get the career that you want that will support the lifestyle you want, then you should check out the Most Valuable Dev Summit. I've invited some of my friends across the community, people that you've heard of, people that have worked on systems that you use on a daily basis, people who have invented new ways of doing things over the years in programming, and I've asked them one question. And that question is, how do you become a top 5% developer? How do you become 1 in 20 of the best developers out there? And so we're going to go ahead and have that conversation with them in interviews on the Most Valuable Dev Summit. And you can find that at summit.mostvaluable.dev. Well, we usually wrap up with picks. Now, picks are just shout outs about stuff we like. Eric, do you want to shout out about some stuff first?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually opening up an article that landed in my inbox, let's see, 2 days ago. It was Elixir Digest. And the first pick is an article called Learning Elixir, Phoenix and Live View, a Primer for Experienced Programmers. And I was like, wow, this title is exactly what I'm looking for. I have the Elixir book by Dave Thomas, which is brilliant. But it's a long read, and this was like a super short and concise read. I posted it here in the show notes, and just loved it because it's like it covers a lot of Elixir concepts in one go, and then it jumps into Phoenix, and then it jumps into Live View, and I was like, wow, this is really, really cool, and has a bunch of very useful links. Super well written. So yeah, for all you Elixir beginners out there, or anyone who just want to repeat Elixir basics, this is really a good one.
Awesome. I'm going to go out with a couple of picks here. The first one that I'm going to shout out is a new podcast that I'm starting. So I'm starting a new podcast this week. Starts on Wednesday, tomorrow. It's called the Dev Influencers Podcast. You can find it at devinfluencers.com/podcast. It's also on devchat.tv. So if you go to devchat.tv and look for it, you should be able to find it there too. But I've been doing the Dev Influencers Accelerator here for a while, for about 2 months. And I've been coaching some folks on starting their podcasts and getting started building an audience and serving that audience and making a difference for that audience. And, you know, we're getting to the point where we're starting to get some podcasts launched, and it's pretty exciting. But the other thing is that I really feel like, and I've talked to a bunch of people, and I'm really feeling like the community out there needs more influencers, needs more people out there who are willing to put themselves out there and go out of their way to serve the community and help other people. And this isn't just a purely selfless act. I mean, you get so much from doing it, right? You gain reputation, you get to go speak at the conferences, you get to go and connect with people who know who you are. Eventually you get to the point where Eric mentioned Kent C. Dodds, right? He's selling courses. You know, I've written a book and been selling that. I'm selling the accelerator now. And so there are other ways. I lived on the podcast for 6 years, right? And so there are all these opportunities that come with being an influencer as well. And so there's a little bit of give and take, but it's mostly you give, right? And then they give back. And everybody loves that part of it, right? Nobody feels like they're losing out on it. And it's just kind of this beautiful relationship. And so I wanted to talk about that on a podcast and help inspire people to go out and become influencers and then talk about some of the ways that you can do that. And so that's what the show is. So you can go find it at devinfluencers.com/podcast. If you want to join the accelerator, you can just go to devinfluencers.com. Put your name and email address in. It'll take you to the application. The name and email address is just so I can follow up, right? So if I get a name and email address and don't get an application, I can go, hey, did you get busy, right? Kind of thing. And so, yeah, you just give me some information. If it's a good fit, we'll set up a strategic call. We'll talk for an hour or so and just see where you're at, where you're trying to get to, who you want to serve, that kind of a thing. And then, yeah. We'll see if it makes sense to get you into the accelerator, right? Because it has to make sense for you and for me. I've talked to a few people that actually we get in, we start talking, and we figure out that they just need to tweak a couple of things in their job and they're happy where they are, right? And, you know, so then it's like, you know, I'm not trying to sell them on joining the accelerator because it's not for them, right? It's for people who are trying to do these other things. So I'm just going to put that out there. A few other picks. So last night, my wife and I actually went out on a date, like out of the house on a date, which was so nice. We went out to dinner at Olive Garden, which was terrific. And then we went and saw a movie at the movie theater. And there were 4 people in the movie theater. We were 2 of them. So it was great. We went and saw The Courier, which is a movie with Benedict Cumberbatch in it. Now, just to give people an idea, so it's a spy movie. But it is based on real events. It's during the Cold War, and they recruit this. You'll see all this in the trailer if you watch it. They recruit a salesman, a civilian, to essentially carry intelligence from the Soviet Union to London. And then that intelligence gets passed along to the Americans, right? And anyway, it's this really fascinating story of this guy that does this. You know, he's exceptionally brave. And when we walked out of the theater, there were the girls that were sitting, you know, like 3 rows up behind us, the only other 2 people in the theater. They were walking out and one of the girls said, it was okay. And the other girl goes, yeah, it was okay. I was expecting something more like James Bond. And I'm sitting there going, did you watch the trailer? It was pretty obvious it wasn't a James Bond type movie. But anyway, you know, so yeah, if you're looking for like this action adventure movie, this is not that movie. You know, not a whole lot of shooting and running and jumping out of windows and stuff. But if you're into kind of the Cold War history stuff and, you know, where they got some of the intel on some of the things that occurred in the 60s during the Cold War, it was an excellent movie. It was fascinating. Really, really, really loved it. So I'm going to pick that as my non-technical, non-stuff I'm working on pick. All right, Adi, what are your picks?
I was not prepared for picks, but since Eric mentioned a book, I think just Elixir in Action is always a great book for, you know, beginners. I think it's the best Elixir book. Well, hopefully not for too long. But yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. All right. And if people want to find you on the internet and connect with you, we'll put a link to your blog post, which obviously leads to your website. But I'm also guessing you're on like Twitter and GitHub, right?
Yeah, I'm not really on Twitter, but yeah, GitHub, LinkedIn, people can feel free to reach out. I actively mentor at this point for people in Elixir. And, you know, if anyone is looking to get into Elixir and need help, how to approach their career, where to start, please reach out. I'm happy to help.
Awesome. Well, if you could put those links in the chat, we'll get them in the show notes. And then thanks for coming. I mean, this was fun. It's always fun just to geek out on testing and writing code. And it's fun to see where these things go. So thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right,
folks. Good, buddy. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot.
Until next time, max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.